shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Shooting from the Lip on Sputnik International with me, John Gaunt. I've got a great guest for you today. He's not a politician, but he understands politics. I say he understands them from the street. Who is he? Well, he's the film writer, filmmaker, social writer, communicator, social commentator, Mr. Dougie Brimson, and he joins us now.
Shooting from the lip.
Hiya, Dougie.
Hello, John.
Good to have you on board. Right, let's talk about film writing. How did you get into film writing, and how did you end up making a massive movie with Elijah Wood called Green Street?
It was like most things that happen in my life, it was just down to luck. I'd written a few books about the culture of football, and someone sent me a link to a woman who was researching the idea of doing a film about, you know, the football culture and all that sort of stuff. And I replied to her using a fake name just to test out who she was and what she was up to, because this was in the early 90s, and at that time the police were all over the internet trying to catch everybody. And it just unfolded from there, really. I got talking to her, sounded her out. She was sound. We talked about the initial idea. She flew me out to Hollywood. We fleshed out a script. And halfway through the process, she was nominated for an Oscar for a short movie that she'd made. And all of a sudden, people started throwing money at us. And it carried on from there, really.
Okay, so it didn't start from a book you had written like your other books?
No, it was a pure, I mean, one of the criticisms of Green Street is that it's very, not fake, but it's very Americanized. I mean, it's a very dubious kind of plot. But that all came from America. You know, they wanted that. They needed that. One of the reasons it was about Millwall was because the producers in America had heard about Millwall. I initially wrote it about Arsenal and Tottenham, but it was changed to West Ham and Millwall because that was the big rivalry. They knew all about Millwall. They managed to get inside West Ham to film, which itself was a dodgy process. And it carried on from there, really. But at one particular point, we were having so many arguments about the script that I was effectively sidelined from the project. So, and I just let them get on with it. It was a case of literally taking the money and running.
Okay, let's just go back a step. You said the police were all over the internet, what, looking for hooligans, so to speak. And indeed, were you ever a hooligan or a casual yourself? Is that where the writing started, based on your own experiences?
No, but the writing started from, I left the Air Force. I took redundancy from the RAF. I'd done 18 years by then, in 1994. And the build-up to Euro 96 had already started. And there was this kind of mass media furore about the potential for World War III involving football hooligans and stuff like that. And everything that was being written was just, for want of a better word, rubbish. And Eddie and I, my younger brother, we were kind of thinking about, well, maybe there's a book in this, because we were always looking for an angle to make money, you know, basically off the back of going so we could go football. And we just had an idea for a book, and we began talking to a lot of people. And our experiences as lads who followed Watford, we were Watford fans, and we'd been going for years, certainly since the beginning of the 80s when hooliganism was everywhere. And our experiences of lads, casual lads, if you like, who were on the peripheries of the hardcore organised hooligan scene because we were Watford supporters, and that's quite important. We weren't West Ham or Millwall or Arsenal. Or Leeds or anything like that. Our football life was generally spent trying to avoid getting involved in any trouble, being part of that scene, if you like, the Saturday scene, as it calls.
Okay, so what was the first book called, and what happened as a result of that?
Well, our first book was called Everywhere We Go, and it looked at the culture from two people who was on the outside of it, or on the edges of it, looking in. And the book was a mixture of anecdotes and opinion. Based on why we'd got involved, what it was all about, the impact of the media, the impact of the police, issues such as racism and stuff like that. And that book was called Everywhere We Go. It's still available on Amazon. In fact, you can download it for free from Amazon at the moment. And it was massive. And it was massive because in the build-up to Euro 96, Eddie and I were quite happy to go and talk about the book in the media. And all of a sudden, the media have got these two shaven-headed blokes who are quite eloquent
yeah.
and happy to sit there and say, this is why we did it, this is what we got out of it, this is how you would stop it, and this is why everything else is crap.
Okay, and then that led to Green Street, as you say. You say you took the money and ran. I mean, do you mind me asking, did you make a fortune? Did you become a Hollywood writer as a result of that?
No, I didn't make a fortune, funnily enough. And there's a story to be had in the finances of Green Street and most films, for that matter. But what it did do is, you know, it gave me a name. And even to this day, everybody has heard of Green Street. So as soon as, you know, you introduce yourself as the writer of Green Street, then you've got some cred. Ironically, I've kind of tended to move away from doing working in films because I don't particularly enjoy it. It's a pretty grim industry to be involved in, largely because of the shysters who work in that industry. And there are an awful lot of them, let me tell you.
A lot of people might want to know, did you actually meet Elijah Wood?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was on set. Initially, I was on set quite a lot. And then I kind of distanced myself from it because I was just getting involved in more and more arguments. And when you write something and you're sitting there watching it being filmed and acted out and you're thinking, this is wrong. And all I could think of was, when this comes out, I'm going to get slaughtered because it's my name as the writer. And I'm, you know, on the back of all these books I've written, everybody's going to blame me for everything that's gone wrong, that is wrong in it. And that continues to this day.
So are you embarrassed by Green Street? There's a question.
No, because it's got me where I am today in terms of film. I mean, I've done 3 films now. I've got another 3 or 4 in development that I've already written. I haven't got to do any more work on them. So how can you be embarrassed by something that was that big? It could have been better, but that wasn't my decision. And people who are generally critical of the film, with the greatest of respect, don't tend to understand how the writing process works in terms of, by the fact that the cameras are rolling, the writer is history.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I've got no impact in it. And so, no, how can you be embarrassed by something that was that massive? It's crazy.
OK, let's talk now then about modern football. I mean, a lot of people are saying football's gone back to those bad old dark days, hooliganism coming back, racism. What do you make of the latest furore about football?
I think football's an evolutionary beast by nature. You know, it's always changing. Sky has changed everything. I've always argued that football is kind of reflective in what's going on society, in society, because you've got this mass working class movement, and that's what football is. It's a working class sport. It always will be.
Do you think it is a working class sport now, even though we've got the Vol-au-Vent Brigade and we're told we can't shout abuse at the players, even if it's not racist? Are you sure it's still a working class game? 70 quid a ticket?
Of course it is. You look at the Premier League is the pinnacle of the sport. That's fine. But you look at the First Division, the Second Division, the non-league. It's a working class sport. You know, let's get some realism here.
Okay.
And I think people, it's reflective of the fact that this country is quite angry at the moment. And one of the outlets for that anger and one of the outlets for that kind of tribal behaviour is football, and it always will be football.
Of course, we've got the Football Lads Alliance and the Democratic Football Lads Alliance. What do you make of them?
Initially, people don't understand the DFLA. I think that they fell victim to the fact of, A, they were quite successful. I was on the first 2 big marches in London, and I was quite active in the background. I tried to be quite active and supportive in the background. But it all went horribly wrong because they fell victim to the attacks that they were all racist. They're all thugs and all that crap, which, if you know anything about them, isn't true.
No, I've interviewed them.
Yeah, so you know. So but there was no one to defend them. And one of the problems we have with anybody who sits even slightly right of centre in this country is that they are lining themselves up for attack, particularly on social media. And you know as well as I do that anyone with a public persona who is right wing, who sticks their head above the parapet, is going to get shot at almost immediately.
And again, with no disrespect to football fans, they're not necessarily the most eloquent or articulate, are they? So sometimes they can write something which is full of passion, what they believe in, and some snobby, wet-behind-the-ears Oxbridge graduate working for The Independent can twist that. And suddenly there's a Twitter storm, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's not unique to the DFLA, and it's not unique to what's going on at the moment. I mean, I learned very quickly when I started doing radio stuff in the mid-90s that recorded radio interviews are fraught with danger.
Yeah.
Because they can cut and edit you. I mean,
always
I did
go
an
live. Always go live.
Always. I did an interview which was about racism. And I was talking about, you know, the anti-football, anti-racism movements within football, the fan-driven anti-racism movements within football. And when the interview was cut, it was like I was a rabid Nazi.
Is it kind of a demonisation of the working class, do you think, sometimes?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a demonisation of football fans in general. But again, that's gone on since the 80s.
OK, let me ask you another question then. You, being a Watford fan, what about Tommy Robinson? Of course, a Luton fan. Where do you stand on Tommy, on what he has done and where he is now, and the fact that he's essentially a persona non grata when it comes to social media? Do you think he should be?
I'm not exactly a supporter of the way he goes about things. I've got the utmost respect for the guy, the fact that he's prepared to go out on a limb entirely for what he believes in. But as we were just saying, if you stick your head above the parapet, you're going to get slaughtered, and no one has been more slaughtered than that guy.
He's standing as an MEP now. What do you make of that up in the northwest? Do you think he's got a hope in hell of being elected?
Well, I'm in the southeast, so I've got no idea. It wouldn't surprise me. And to be honest, if I were Tommy Robinson, I would have done the same.
Okay. Do you think he represents a sizable proportion of working class views at the moment? What do you reckon?
I think he represents somebody that a sizable group needs to have in terms of they need someone to follow. And he represents, like it or not, he represents the views of an awful lot of people in this country. And that goes back to something I've said before. Well, you just said the demonization of the white working classes. I've argued many times that the most attacked group in this country is the white working class male, because we get slaughtered at every single turn.
And do you think it's dangerous then, not just with Tommy, but with other people, where this white working class, of which I'm one, of course, you're one as well, that we're kind of being ostracised, we're being quietened down, we're being censored. We've got to censor ourselves on social media. I think that's perfectly obvious at the moment. Do you think this is dangerous for democracy? I personally think it is, because I'm no way am I a racist, but if I get treated like that, the danger is it goes behind the curtains, behind the front door. What do you think?
I think if you demonise everybody in the way that certain elements of society have been demonised, then if you lump everybody in together, the more vocal and more anti-social groups are the ones who are going to have the voice, and everybody who is going to follow him in. I mean, we've had basically what's gone on certainly since social media has exploded is you've had the suppression of debate, of right-wing debate. You see on Twitter is raging with the left who are attacking everything to do that's even slightly right of centre. And people on the right don't want to get involved in those debates because they're going to get attacked almost instantly.
But how does that happen? When we voted for Brexit, we voted for, I'm talking globally here, Donald Trump. What's happened in Catalonia? What's happening in Italy? What's happening in the new European countries? You know, when it comes to democracy, people are voting right of centre. The governments are right of centre. I mean, apart from the Conservatives here. But somehow the left control the whole of the media, the whole of public discourse.
Because the reason for that is, one of the reasons these parties, the Brexit Party and stuff like that, are so successful is because they're giving a voice to the silent majority. And this is one of the things in the referendum in 2016 that suddenly happened. You know, I voted Leave. I always wanted to leave. And I voted Leave along with 17.4 million people who were the silent majority. And nobody were listening to us. And all of a sudden, we're given an opportunity. Yeah, now you can have your say. And that's why Nigel Farage was so successful with UKIP, because suddenly there was a party that represented people. And it's the same with the Brexit Party at the moment.
We'll go on to that in a minute, Dougie, but okay. Hold on a minute. He didn't win, did he, as it turns out? He won a battle, he won a skirmish. We are still not out of the EU. And do you think that is going to lead to anger? And is that anger being suppressed at the moment?
I think people are furious. Furious in this country. At football yesterday, two people came up to me, just normal people, and said, I've paid 25 quid to the Brexit Party this week because I want out of the EU, because they've let us down. And these are people who have never been involved in politics before. People are furious, absolutely furious. I'm furious. We should be out by now. And they're going on about money being spent, blah, 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 blah. The money that's being lost because these people haven't fulfilled the referendum result is a scandal.
Dougie Brimson, Shooting from the Lip. You're listening to John Gaunt. It's Sputnik International, Shooting from the Lip. Don't dare go away. We're going to talk about the Brexit Party. We're going to talk about the Falklands War, which, of course, Dougie was involved in. He was in the RAF for 18 years. We're going to talk about the treatment of veterans. We're going to talk about Donald Trump. And we will talk more about Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party. Don't dare go away.
Shooting from the Lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, Shooting from the Lip.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's Shooting from the Lip with the film writer, social commentator, Dougie Brimson. Dougie, you were getting well passionate just before the break there. Let's talk about that in a bit more detail. We haven't got a yellow shirt protest here. We're not getting riots on the street. Is that because we're British? Or do you think something like the poll tax riots could well happen from what you're hearing on the football terraces?
Well, there are yellow vest protests going on. No, nobody seems to hear about them. And I think a lot of things that are going on in this country I see and I get told about are not being broadcast in the mainstream media at all. One only has to look at, you know, on Good Friday, there were 10,000 veterans marching down Whitehall and down Pall Mall. We were standing at 10,000 veterans standing outside Buckingham Palace singing the national anthem before they marched back up the Mall and down Whitehall. And it never got reported anywhere until we started screaming blue murder. And all of a sudden it popped up on a couple of places somewhere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, of course, there was the bikers' protest, wasn't it? Sound of Thunder or whatever it was called. It got no mainstream media. So there's a massive censorship happening, is there?
I believe there is. I believe that the media are certainly censoring any kind of protest, which, again, can be perceived as being right wing. And it's funny that, you know, the climate change protesters were wall to wall coverage.
And also, of course, they were very much softly, the way they were dealt with. What do you make of the way they were dealt with?
Can you imagine if the DFLA had marched and sat down on Westminster Bridge for 4 days? Can you imagine that the police would have been, you know, running up and down on skateboards or dancing to the music while we were there? Absolutely not.
And, of course, you only have to recall the Countryside Alliance, where people got bloodied and battered. I'm not having a go at the police, actually, here. It's about the people who command them and their political masters who send them in. So you think they got treated with kid gloves. What did you make of the little girl who's been over from Sweden, who's telling us the whole world's going to end?
I just find it very odd. There's something very Stepford Wives about her, and I don't know what it is. I think that, you know, you've got a girl who's got an autistic child who is being kind of pushed forward. Something's not right there, and I don't know what it is. It's very uncomfortable with me.
Yeah, same here.
But the message she's putting out is right. This morning, I was watching the it was the London Marathon this morning, and I'm watching the BBC coverage, and there was some guy on there who wanted to do a marathon in every single country of the world. And he was flying off back to Dubai this week or somewhere. And the first thing I thought of when I watched him was, what's your carbon footprint? Well, you're flying around the planet doing, you know, all these marathons trying to raise money for some charity. And 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have thought like that. So the message is coming across.
And to a certain extent, I agree with the message. I don't want the planet to be wrecked. I'm not necessarily buying into man-made climate change, but the globe is getting warmer. I can understand that. I understand about, you know, don't use single-use plastics. I've got into that. I've got that message. But I don't really need a 16-year-old girl to tell me. Just go back a minute to the protest. Do you think there could be riots?
I think that will depend on what happens in the last few months. I mean, obviously, no one wants to see that kind of stuff. The irony is, of course, that the DFLA, the veterans, all those marches pass by almost totally peacefully, and yet the climate change protests, we had 1,000 arrests. You know, what's that all about? Why is that okay? And you know, the right wing isn't. This kind of mantra in this country that left is right and right is always wrong. It infuriates me.
I keep saying that. When did it become the case that to be right was to be wrong? And as I say, no one's really voted for that, have they? Okay, you talked about the Falklands there. Let's just, not the Falklands, sorry, veterans. What do you think of the treatment of veterans in this country?
I think the treatment of veterans is beyond shameful, to be fair. I think we owe a debt, and I'm speaking as a citizen, not just as a veteran, I think the way that we have kind of abdicated that responsibility to charity, which is exactly what's happened, is a shameful reflection of this country. You know, for years, it was unfashionable, almost anathema to say that you were a veteran in this country because you were akin to being a leper. And now that's finally started to change as the veteran groups are starting to get organised.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because the cliche is to say, compare it to America, where veterans are always getting cheaper to theatres and Disney, and they always get applauded and the rest. But is that cliche a cliche because it's true, and that somehow the establishment elite look down on veterans, people like you?
I think that the establishment in this country aren't doing enough. They're certainly hanging the veterans out to dry, in not just, you know, Soldier F and Soldier B, but Marine A, who was hung out to dry. And I was on those, you know, all of those protests. We don't seem to recognise what these men and women have done for us and continue to do for us.
Should there be any historic prosecutions for what happened on Bloody Sunday, in your opinion?
No. That time has passed. They were cleared by an inquiry. How are you going to get justice, a fair trial? Now, we're in a world which is being driven by ambulance chasing lawyers. And that's what this is all about. It's all about people who can make money out of the government. You just need to look at these people coming back from Syria. Who's driving all that? Who's driving these citizens?
You mean the jihadis when you say that, yeah. And the jihadi brides?
Lawyers. How can this girl get legal aid? You know, and they're talking about millions of pounds of legal aid. Why is there no cap on that legal aid? How has she got it anyway? Because there's some scumbag lawyer who's driving it.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Dougie, as you know, you leave this country to fight for the enemy or do the washing up, as she says she was doing, then I'm afraid you're an enemy combatant. End of, you lose your British passport. Would you agree?
If you're not an enemy combatant, you're a traitor. And what happens to traitors?
Yeah, fair point.
You know, they certainly don't get legal aid.
Does this tie in to how it somehow has become, I mean, not so much as it was, and you mentioned Euro 96 before, where it kind of changed, where suddenly we reclaimed the flag of St. George in particular, but also do you think there's an attack on patriotism all the time, that somehow we're not allowed to be patriotic? Certainly if you're English, you are if you're Scottish or Irish or Welsh, but if you're English, you're not, because somehow you must be a knuckle-dragging moron.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The English have always been the kind of the low-rent members of this union we belong to. I mean, it's interesting that last week the Labour Party suddenly came out and said, oh, if you vote for us, we'll make St. George's Day a national holiday. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. You spent years slaughtering anybody that's even thought about waving a St. George's cross.
Well, look at Emily Thornberry, the comment she made about one of her constituents who had the flag of St. George outside his house during the World Cup. I mean, we know their attitude to it.
Absolutely. And it's just it's this vote, you know, it's Labour vote grabbing exercise, which is kind of bog standard for them.
Do you think there's anything wrong with being nationalistic in the sense of saying, look, I'm proud to be English or proud to be British? Do you think there's anything wrong with that?
How can it be OK for someone to say they're proud to be American, proud to be Irish, proud to be Welsh, proud to be Scottish, proud to be Jamaican, proud to be Indian, and not OK to say you're proud to be English? How is that not right? I don't understand where that argument has come from and how it's been allowed to persist for so long.
I agree with you. Do you think a lot of your views, though, were forged by the fact that you were in the RAF for 18 years, you served in the Falklands or in the Falklands conflict? What do you reckon? And was the Falklands conflict worth it? I asked Simon Weston that question a few weeks ago, and he said, yes, definitely.
Views. I've always been patriotic, and that comes from my parents and my grandparents. It's the way I was brought up to be. I'm immensely proud to be British. Why wouldn't I be? You know, I'm lucked in. Anybody who's British is lucked in. In terms of the Falklands, of course it was worth it. You know, it was democracy. It was an absolute war based on democracy. And we're going through it again at the moment. And the comparisons between, to me, the comparisons about what happened in 1982 and what's happening now, okay, they're being fought on different battlefields, but they're exactly the same.
Let me get this clear then. The war about Brexit is the same as the Falklands. It's about us having the right to determine our own sovereign future. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, of course. Of course it is. I don't want to be ruled by anybody else. We should be making our own decisions. The thing that clinched it for me, I mean, I've always kind of been anti-EU. I know I'm British first. I don't like, you know, the fact that we're being governed from somebody else. However you want to define government, you know, we're still pouring money into somebody else. We're still propping up other countries. I don't like that when we've got problems in this country. But what's clinched it for me was the EU army. And if you give away the power to determine what your own military are doing, you're finished as a democracy.
Okay, I understand that fully.
And that's exactly what will happen unless we get out.
Okay, so what do you think of what's happened in Parliament, or the Commons in particular, over the past 3 years? Have we, the British people, been betrayed?
Yes, of course we have. Because this argument that, well, it was only, you know, more people didn't vote for Brexit than voted for Brexit. It's not my fault if you didn't go out and vote. That's your fault. If you didn't vote, you've got no right to complain. And on the day, 17.4 million people went out and voted to leave the EU. And the fact that that decision hasn't been delivered is a shameful reflection on everybody who is elected to deliver that result.
OK, so now we're going to have the pantomime of these new European elections. Going to cost £100 million. Is Nigel Farage going to sweep the board? Is UKIP dead? And are people going Brexit?
I've never been one for polls, but every poll you see is forecasting that the Brexit Party are going to do astonishing stuff. The people they've got lining up to stand is really a fantastic mix of people. I don't know. I think what it's doing for me, I've been having this debate on Twitter only this morning. I think what the whole thing about the Brexit Party is, it's giving people who would never normally get involved in this process another opportunity to have their say and be listened to. And everybody, I keep hearing people saying, oh, I'm not going to vote. It's not worth it, because they're not listening. I'd urge anybody to vote. Everybody has to vote, because unless you vote, you can't influence change. I don't care if you vote leave or remain. You know, you have to vote, because millions of people over the years have died to give you the right for that vote. And there are millions of people around this world who would give anything to have a vote. So don't waste it.
OK, what would you say to people who say, hang on, he isn't the voice of the people. Farage is another public school educated toff. He's part of the establishment. You're being duped, Dougie Brimson.
Been duped into what? For voting for something I already believe in. I believe we should vote the EU. Nobody else is giving me it. You know, I voted for it once. We won. So where's our victory? So now we've got another chance potentially to earn that victory. So we have to vote for it. Nigel Farage, so you could argue that he's probably been the most influential politician for decades because of what he's brought about. Like him or loathe him, you know, you can't argue about what he's achieved, whatever his motives might be. But he has given me the opportunity to have another say.
Okay, so my final question has got to be a very short answer. Are you optimistic for the future of Britain, and why?
I'm always optimistic because I'm British. And the British are always optimistic because when push comes to shove, we will always pull it off. Always.
That is a brilliant answer. You've been listening to Shooting from the Lip on Sputnik International with my very special guest, the filmmaker, the social commentator, Dougie Brimson. Thanks a lot. I'll be back next week with another edition of Shooting from the Lip with another guest who isn't afraid to raise his or her head over the parapet. Make sure you keep listening. Love to hear your views on it. My name's John Gaunt. That was Shooting from the Lip.
Shooting from the Lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.